How does wilderness EMS care relate back to urban EMS care? We have a special episode of the MedicCast with a crossover panel discussion on the topic from the Disaster Podcast again for you. If that's what you're looking for, you found it right here on this week's episode of the MedicCast.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the MedicCast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the PodMedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of the MedicCast, our podcast for EMTs and paramedics everywhere. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the PodMedic, and I'd like to welcome you to this week's episode. In this episode, we have a special segment on wilderness EMS with a large panel of specialists on the subject. This episode comes to us by way of the Disaster Podcast, which we've been doing a little bit here lately. We'll air this double episode coming up on that channel in a week or so, but I thought I'd bring it to you here on the MedicCast first, so stay tuned to the show for this week and next week. Before we get to all of that, though, I do want to make sure you check out the links and additional information available for you over at the MedicCast blog at MedicCast.com/blog. There's a show notes link at the top of the page. Click that link and it'll take you right to the most recent episode. And of course, you can always scroll down there and find previous episodes too. There's also a search box, so if you're looking for something, use keywords and find what you're looking for. We've covered a lot here in the last 10 years or so. But take some time and make sure you follow up on the information you get on the show each week so that you understand how it applies to your own EMS practice and protocols. If you want to get back in touch with me, you have a question or something, well, you can do that by email to podmedic@mac.com. Shoot me an email with your comments or questions on an episode, or you can send me suggestions and interview ideas for future episodes. Either way, I work hard to respond back to all those emails, and I'll get back to yours as well, so please, please keep those emails coming. That's it for our contact information. Let's go ahead and get on into the rest of the show. It's coming right up in just a sec. This week on the show, we have a special group of excellent panelists on the subject of wilderness EMS as it relates to what an urban medic can take away from it. We have Kevin Ryder from WildSafety.com, Dr. Seth Hawkins from Hawk Ventures, which supports a wide range of wilderness EMS programs, including the flagship Carolina Wilderness EMS Externship Program. Also joining us is Dr. Ben Abo. He's an ER doc and wilderness EMS expert and specialist. And we have paramedic David Pfeiffer, who's a nationally registered paramedic, wilderness search and rescue specialist, and the founder of the Red River Gorge Search and Rescue Team. We also have our regular Disaster Podcast hosts and guests, including paramedic Sam Bradley and USAR doc Dr. Joe Holly. Here's part one of that segment. Part two will be coming up next week, so stay tuned for that next week as well.
So I want to say hi to the Sasquatch, and we call him that because it's hard to catch this guy, and we drag him in here, you know, every couple months. So we want to say hi to Jim Logan in Memphis. Say hi, Jim.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Kevin. Hi, Jim. How's that? Yeah, so man, it's so glad to, I missed you guys a lot. So busy here in Memphis. Had a really great summer so far, but looking forward to this. Looking forward to this episode.
Excellent. This is going to be a great episode. And Dr. Joe Holly, our almost every episode guest, and of course part of our sponsorship with Paragon. Say hi, Joe.
Hey guys, good to be here.
Glad you're here with us. So I'm going to just run through everybody else real quick, and then, of course, we're going to spend some time talking to them. David Pfeiffer, you're from Kentucky.
That's correct. Currently talking to you from Richmond, Kentucky.
Well, tell us just a quick bit about yourself and what you do.
Well, full-time, I'm a lecturer in emergency medical care at Eastern Kentucky University. We're one of the few baccalaureate paramedic programs. And I'm the coordinator of the Red Star Wilderness Response Unit in the Red River Gorge here in Kentucky. We are the backcountry response unit of Powell County EMS.
And we're going to have links, of course, to all of these guys and their wonderful sites that you probably are going to want to go and get more information from. Dr. Seth Hawkins, he's been a guest before. We love him to death, and we got him back for this episode because it's very much wilderness medicine-based, and he's one of the experts. Tell him about yourself, Seth.
Hey, everyone. Yeah, big fan and happy to be on the show again. I'm an emergency physician in North Carolina, board certified in EMS, and I specialize in wilderness medicine. I founded the Carolina Wilderness EMS externship. Our first extern was a young whippersnapper named Ben Abo, and also the Appalachian Center for Wilderness Medicine, and I'm the co-founder of the Wilderness EMS Medical Director course.
Good segue. Thank you. Because we have Dr. Ben Abo with us. He's also a medic. And he happens to be the author of the article to which we will refer. And we call him the Banana Man for reasons we may or may not get into. We got the Sasquatch and the Banana Doc. So that's a long story. So hi, Ben.
Hi. I find it very appealing to be here and be called the Banana Man. So I appreciate it. I'm very excited to talk with y'all.
All right, let's jump into this. We're talking about an article that was written by Dr. Ben Abo for GEMS called Wilderness Medicine Considerations for the Urban Medic. And we thought this was just a great topic that we haven't. We've talked a lot about wilderness medicine kind of here and there and everywhere, but never really translated the differences so much. And that's something that we're going to do tonight. So Kevin's actually worked up some questions primarily for Ben. But certainly we want all of our other experts to jump in with comments, and certainly Jim and Joe to the extent that they have questions. Okay, Kevin, I'm going to toss this to you, and I hope you have your questions warmed up and ready, and let's just jump into it. I'll be in the background here with Jamie, paying attention to what's going on and enjoying this podcast.
Cool. So thanks, everyone, for joining tonight. Hopefully this will be an awesome episode. But Dr. Ben, what was your motivation for writing this article?
Well, it kind of comes down to when I was talking to another former EMS fellow and wilderness guru who I originally met, who took the Wilderness EMS Medical Director's course. And we were talking about some of the different things because he's a rural physician, William Saudi, who co-wrote this article with me. And his experience in EMS and wilderness medicine domestically is very different from mine, being on the disaster team, doing international NGO work, as well as I'm an urban paramedic physician working with City of Miami, Miami-Dade Fire Rescue, Hallandale Beach, Miami Beach, and all. And down here in Florida, you know, we're very attuned to natural disasters, hurricanes and all. And I talk all the time with my medics and firefighters and co-physicians and nurses about, you know, what to do, what will we do to prepare. And they talk about having this tool and that tool and a lot of things where really they have to start to learn that denial is not just a river in Egypt. You know, these natural disasters and things happen even in urban settings. And we know that hurricanes happen in Miami and can easily wipe things out there where and an urban setting can easily become an austere setting. And so having these skills in wilderness medicine is not just, oh, if you're doing an expedition or you're on a family trip in Belize, something happens. It's more of a, this can happen here. We need education. We need to be ready for things because we don't plan on accidents. We don't plan on disasters, although maybe we should. We know it's going to happen.
Awesome. So in your article, you go into different considerations. You discuss when to initiate rescue, what types of scenarios or situations you would consider evacuating somebody without further thought. And then you go into different ways of packaging the patient. And you mention a rope stretcher. So for those people who have never heard about one or seen one, can you describe what a rope stretcher is?
Right. So with regards to the rope stretcher, and a lot of this, I should also kind of step back and say that the other part of this article is kind of a first part an introduction to Wilderness Myths for the urban medics, that they kind of start to understand some of these practices, as well as I'm definitely one that's more of a black cloud for these sort of things, but we can be on vacation and things happen. So these urban medics can be out there and need to help people, just like when you're on a flight and something happens. So you might need to do these kind of different things where people look at you, oh, you're a firefighter, oh, you're a paramedic, oh, you're an EMT. They expect you to have these still similar skill sets that we don't use all the time. And we're not paid for what we do. We're paid for what we're prepared to do. So we should prepare more. With respect to the rope stretcher, we talked about, all the time when I do different wilderness medicine interest group stuff or the different medical schools here in Florida, we talk about some of the cool things of making this rope stretcher and what can you use to make a stretcher if you had to evacuate someone out and do different things. Of course, it's better to have them fix and walk out themselves if someone's hurt in any situation. But if you need to, you can make this rope stretcher, which basically is if you take a long piece of rope and you go back and forth so it zigzags, and then you could put either a stick or poles down either side, or even just pick it up, or even put more rope around the borders. But it creates a cot or a stretcher that a patient can lay on. And when we talk about it within the article, and the way it's usually practiced because it's fun and it's cool and we do these things in the wilderness medicine classes, it's very restricting because you're layering them with blankets and sleeping bags and doing different things. But with the ropes that go back and forth underneath and then on top, you really lose access to your patient. That's one of the things that we refer to there with patient packaging.
Awesome. So obviously, if someone is going to be doing this, they want to have some rope in their kit. Do you have any suggestions on some general items that somebody might want to have with them if they were to get in any kind of situation that becomes a backcountry or wilderness setting, such as a natural disaster or an extended outing in the woods or wilderness? Nothing too specific, but like a general overall.
Overall, all the suggestions really are come down to it really depends. It depends if we're talking about how should you prepare it at home? What's, you know, for instance, I live in Miami. What's in my go bag? When it's hurricane season, I have a bin I take out, and there's certain things that I have. If I'm responding or I'm going hiking in certain areas, what I have and carry is different than when I'm backpacking and I'm the medical chaperone when I'm backpacking in Africa providing medical care. For the most part, a lot of these calls or types of patients are trauma-related. Or simple GI bugs and dehydration. So obviously water filtration is very important. A way to signal and communicate is very important. And basic trauma care, even a simple tourniquet, which is much easier to carry than a whole lot of bandaging and tape. And then when you talk about things like the rope stretcher and all, you need a significant amount of rope. Am I carrying all this rope all the time? Absolutely not. Am I carrying it off an ambulance out for every single call? No. It kind of depends on what's going on and what the type of call would be or what kind of the expedition is. But for the most part, think dehydration. Think what you can do, MacGyver medicine, to make a good splint and bleeding control for basic trauma care.
So, Ben, what do you think the biggest challenge is, the biggest challenge in the back, for backcountry medicine?
I'd say that biggest challenge in backcountry medicine, similar for wilderness medicine or disaster medicine, comes down to, something I often quote myself saying, and I already mentioned before, is number one, realizing that denial is not just forever in Egypt. Something can happen. Things happen to skilled people. Things happen to backcountry people. Things happen to urban people. So just understand that things can happen. You don't have to be a worry and wrap yourself in bubble wrap no matter what. But you need to not have denial that things can happen. The other thing is just training. How do you decide what you should practice? How do you decide what equipment to have or what training to do? So a lot of that just comes down to realizing and thinking ahead and thinking of the different possibilities.
Hey, Ben, let me throw a question in here because we're kind of talking about this on the side. I know a lot of people don't know the answer to this, nor can I say I do, and maybe there isn't a difference, but when you talk about backcountry, how is that different from wilderness medicine, or is there a difference?
For the most part, I'd say the difference between backcountry medicine and wilderness medicine is spelling. That's really it. When, you know, and this also brings up what even got me initially into wilderness medicine and all. Wilderness medicine, austere medicine, disaster medicine, backcountry medicine, basically is any episode where something's going, you have a patient or patients, and they can be, you know, anywhere from one patient to hundreds of patients. But basically your geography or resources really are lacking. Maybe it takes too long to get to definitive care. Maybe you don't have the means to transport someone to there. Maybe you don't have the means to communicate to get help to there. So really it's this austere environment where you lack the resources to really care for what's needed, especially compared to, you know, you're in downtown Gainesville, you call 911 because you're having chest pain. You don't have the same resources in the middle of Linville Gorge or the Grand Canyon or Africa.
Hey, this is Seth Hawkins. I might weigh in here as well with a thought. In our system, for our special operations team, we have the Jimmy Winters principle. So Jimmy Winters is a captain in our system, and his message to one of my externs as they described an especially intricate plan for extricating a patient was, well, you said that easy. And I think a lot of times urban rescuers may have concepts of how things might work in the wilderness, and I'll bet David has lived through this many times. Things get very complicated in the woods and in alpine environments for things that you don't expect. So a lot of plans that seem very simple become very complicated just by basic environmental factors like wearing a lot of clothing and gear or not having much space to work in or the sun going away. I think that's something that's pretty pervasive in EMS, where hospital-based providers often don't understand how difficult things can be in EMS simply because of the circumstances of the environment. And that's exacerbated even more in the wilderness setting. So, you know, running an operation in New Hampshire in January, about an hour away from the road, is exceptionally difficult in ways that's really hard to train by scenario or to describe to anyone. They really have to live it. So I would echo what Ben's saying about training, that actually, if you plan to do any kind of wilderness operational activities, actually getting out there and experiencing the environment you'll be working in is quite sobering for you know, the challenges that can come up just operationally.
Oh, definitely. And yeah. I think another thing to add too, if I can jump in real quick, some basic outdoor skill sets, I think, are a must. If you have a patient and it's cold outside and you need to spend the night and you need to keep them warm, if you don't know how to build a shelter or start a fire, those two play a key element in patient care that I think get overlooked a lot.
Yeah, I would agree with both of that. And I think touching on what Seth said in particular, the Red River Gorge, where I operate in Kentucky, is a very popular outdoor recreation spot. So it has been developed somewhat. There's paved roads, and there's packed gravel roads, and there's bathrooms at the trailheads. And it's friendly. It's a friendly place for families to come and hike. But we have a lot of pretty intense wilderness calls because of those unexpected aspects of reality. So, you know, we might be responding to a patient who's injured 2 or 3 miles from the trailhead, which is along a paved road, but we have to rig multiple steep and high angle belays to get the Stokes basket back out that we packaged the patient in. And so it becomes a extended operation of many hours requiring some prolonged field care concepts. So it kind of makes me wonder, Ben, what is your definition of wilderness? You know, some people talk about 3 hours from definitive care or such and such distance from a roadway. But when you're just a stone's throw from a roadway, but you still have to spend hours to carry the patient out, it seems like that's wilderness to me. So what are your thoughts on that?
You know, that's absolutely a great question. And, you know, we talk about time or distance or just the lack of resources. Anything can obviously change. And I go back to it but when a disaster comes through where things are blocked. I was just recently lecturing to my Miami Beach fire rescue medics, and we're talking about drowning and water-related trauma and certain things that we're starting to see more of. And I reminded them that they have all this beautiful equipment, and they run three on a rescue truck. And a rescue truck in South Florida is what we call an ambulance. So you run three paramedic firefighters on every ambulance for all these calls. But what if you can't get those people or the equipment to there? For exactly those reasons. A lot of Miami-Dade County is way out there where sometimes the helicopter actually beats an ambulance when you're talking about with the Native Americans and all. And then we as well as different keys and different things far out in the water. So there's this beautiful wilderness even right within urban settings or right nearby, as well as one of the largest urban parks is right in the middle of Miami, Olathe State Park. Where we had a spinal injury in the water, and you have to take care of water-related lung injuries and worry about spinal cord, and you have to get them out. And it's in a shallow area where even the county fireboat, which is basically a giant jet ski that needs very little clearance, couldn't get up to where it was. So that definition of wilderness and austere medicine really is able to flex depending on your resources and how long it takes to do things. When I was doing the Wilderness EMS externship with Seth, we actually had a call where someone was out in the off-road vehicle park and broke his spine, landed doing a jump on his back. And we had decided, you know, do we carry him out on the ATV, which would take time and we were losing sunlight and people would get hurt, or do we call in for NC Heart? And when we did that, and what NC Heart is basically calling in a Blackhawk or something equivalent to winch them out, because you can't just drive back there. We had to make a fire, so we had to clear the debris and make a fire and warm them up. And my medics, and for the most part, me, you know, we're not used to doing that, those kinds of things. But even the urban medics might have to when a disaster or hurricane comes through, or they're out in these expeditions and all.
Ben, that's awesome. Actually kind of segues into another question which we had. But, you know, it's one thing to package the patient, which is going to be very different than it is in the urban setting. But then there is getting them out of there. And you may or may not have air resources. But to what extent are you able to use those? Are they usually available to you? Or what would be your other means of getting a patient out of there? And what kind of equipment would you use?
You know, this is some of the beauty of why I love this and these topics and kind of things, because you really have to think on your feet. That's why I like EMS. That's why I like emergency medicine and international stuff, too, because when I'm doing this kind of stuff and I'm developing an EMS system in Ethiopia, which is a dirt bike-based ambulance, imagine a dirt bike with a sidecar as a modified ambulance for off-road, you know, you don't have all these cool rescue tools. In Miami-Dade County, we have air rescue. We have a fireboat that can get out there. And, you know, how you package them and you use these brand-type things in different baskets and all, similar to what you'd see in Coast Guard movies and all. You know, I was even on a call with the fireboat, and we had to go 4 miles out to sea to pull someone with a GI bleed off a cruise ship. And you think, oh, you just pull the boat up to the cruise ship, and, you know, that's that. No, you have to kind of package them correctly, and how do you line up the boats and deal with the flow and the waves and everything. You know, what do you want to give people? I have love handles, but you need to give patients real handles so that you can maneuver them and move them around. Where are those handles? How are you going to grab it? What are you going to use? Are the heights going to be equivalent? Do you need to carry people out? Do you need to go up an embankment, or do you just need to carry someone? And all of that comes into play with deciding what you're going to use and what you're going to need. Down in Miami-Dade and Broward, you have a lot of resources, but they'll fly a helicopter like nothing. You need it, they're there. It really doesn't take much, and they will fly through some pretty intense weather if needed also. Granted, I will say that I've never felt unsafe every time that I ride with Air Rescue. They're amazing, but they go through a lot. They put themselves through a lot to be able to get there for patients. In other places, you don't have those kinds of resources. I'm now working and just started at University of Florida up in Gainesville in Alachua County and all, and working with Shands Care, where we have critical care and trauma transport and all, but they don't have the hoisting capabilities that we have, you know, in Arizona or with NC Heart, with the Blackhawks we have down in Miami-Dade. So knowing what you have or what resources are available or potentially available are extremely important. And it really is scenario based. Know what you might have or might need. If I'm doing something where I'm doing an extended trip or medical chaperone, or I even need to go and rescue one kid, and I know that there's a bunch of other kids, I'm not going to bring as many large sized items. I might plan accordingly for that. So really, you have to stay flexible and think about what your mission is and what's going on.
And, awesome. And Ben, I have to back up here just a second because I realized I failed in my mission to introduce you properly. So why don't you just jump in and tell us a little bit more about yourself and what you do?
Ah, I appreciate that. I basically am an EMS physician or paramedic physician here in Florida. I actually graduated from residency down in Miami Beach recently and just started an EMS fellowship here at University of Florida in Gainesville. So I'll be working here as an emergency medicine attending. And I've been actually staying very active in EMS. I've been in EMS for about 19 years now, starting as an EMT in New Jersey and paramedic in Pittsburgh, and took some time off to do some international development abroad. And I've been active as well on the clinically, on top of my medical direction duties down in Miami, the Hallandale Beach Fire Rescue and all. But I'm also a physician for our DMAT team, the Disaster Medical Assistance team, and also our Urban Search and Rescue team, Task Force 1 with Miami-Dade Fire Rescue. And then furthermore, on top of that, I'm one of the instructors along with Seth for the Wilderness EMS Medical Directors course.
Wow, that's a lot of stuff. And actually, you cover what I do in DMAT and what Dr. Joe does in USAR. So you're a busy guy.
Keep him busy.
I was just about to ask. Right.
What's that?
I was just about to ask Joe, what do you think the similarities are, if any, between what you do in USAR and what we're doing here?
Well, this is Joe. I think there are quite a few, you know, certainly when it comes to the sort of thinking on your feet and MacGyvering the situation together, that's not at all uncommon. And I think for USAR, it's a lot of transitions between those different scenarios that you were talking about earlier, where you go from a completely austere environment in New Orleans, for example, that, you know, has everything down and is nothing but a giant flood zone, to areas that are impacted like Moore, Oklahoma, by a tornado but have relatively intact surrounding infrastructure. And so you're crossing between all those different versions of various amounts of wilderness and austere environment and urban environment as just part of your daily practice. So, you know, I think it's very much the same mindset. It's very much the same set of skills and tools and very much the same kind of medicine.
You know, this is David. It's so funny that you guys mentioned this because on the Red Star unit that I coordinate here in the Red River Gorge, which is really focused on the wilderness, we recruited several members from Ohio Task Force 1 USAR team because of that overlap of skill sets. Even though it is in some sense sort of the opposite, they get into, you know, breaking and breaching concrete and WMD hazmat things, and meanwhile Red Star is about backcountry ALS, that skill set of being able to operate in an austere environment, in different temperature ranges, and having to work with basically just the gear that you're carrying on your back at the time translates directly. And that is actually translated into potential involvement of our team in Kentucky's new state USAR task force that they may be trying to form. So we see a lot of overlaps in those skill sets. And that kind of got me thinking about a question for you, Ben. Do you see value in the wilderness medicine, the sorts of scenarios that you typically learn in a wilderness medicine course? Do you see value in that for helping develop the creative thinking abilities of traditional EM residents? Do you feel like that's there's like some value added in the residents' training process by doing a little WFA course or even a woofer?
You know what, David? That's an absolutely beautiful question. As beautiful as that interaction, you closing that gap between Ohio and coming and joining your team there, because that over-reliance on certain skill sets is often forgotten. With respect to the skill sets that come from it, I think it's a huge, huge, huge value. In fact, I started another group here called FLOMA, which is just, we have a Facebook group, but we're actually getting started to have the website, which is the Florida Outdoor and Wilderness Medical Association, just trying to get medical students, nurses, PAs, residents, an opportunity to get more of these skill sets that you would learn from a woofer or WFA or any of those things, AWLS, some of those skill sets to learn not only for outside stuff and doing these activities in beautiful Florida, which you can come and visit even when it's hurricane season. We've got a lot to do. But I do think it translates into the ED. There's a lot of things where I can think on the fly and you know, this machine's down or I don't have that tool. You need to think differently. You have to think outside the box. It's very easy for me to think outside the box because I just don't get in the box. I take all these wilderness medicine stuff. I do these different skill sets so I can stay outside the box and I'm ready for different things. I'm very excited. I recently was talking just 2 days ago with a lot of the new residents here at University of Florida that are very interested in wilderness medicine, have done different woofer stuff. And I already see it just in their conversations when we talk about different cases within the ER. Their ways of thinking are completely different than my junior residents that I worked with down in Miami Beach. So there are definitely skills and thought processes that translate over and are very beneficial to the, you know, lack of better words, traditional medical education.
Hey, I could jump in here. It's Seth Hawkins again, just to bounce off a couple threads that I think deserve to be expanded. We had mentioned earlier the importance of familiarity with wilderness environments and how just basic backcountry skills are pretty critical. And I definitely think that that's true. Really, one of the hallmarks of those skill sets, as well as wilderness medicine, is improvisation. And I think that that may be the heart and soul of wilderness medicine, and it becomes a little bit diluted in wilderness EMS because we become accustomed to having certain tools available that we plan to bring in to the environment. And that's in the micro level, like having an IV or having even like orientation equipment. Like there's a longstanding debate in the outdoors community about whether GPS units are the best thing since sliced bread because they solve so many problems, or if they're actually creating an entire generation of outdoors enthusiasts who can't use a map and compass. So really, I think one of the important lessons on a micro level, just like Ben was saying, is not even anticipating a box. Like you may have your hand tied behind your back and one eye is blinded by the tick that embedded in it, and you still have to take care of that patient. And so learning how to use multiple tools in multiple ways is a big part of this. Many of us, when we think about patient care, we think about building a kit. We think about multiple uses for anything that we have. And I think the stretcher that we discussed earlier is a great example of that. And then in a macro sense, you know, here in the Southeast, there are no Mountain Rescue Association endorsed teams. The furthest one to the west is Phoenix, and the furthest one to the north is Pittsburgh. So Mountain Rescue Association teams, which are much more common in New England and out west, train personnel to do ground-up climbing rescues and to have EMS personnel who are duly qualified as climbers and as EMS personnel. Here in my specific operational region, we've become very reliant on the Black Hawk helicopters that Ben describes, which is great. Like having that asset is huge, but they will not always be available. They'll sometimes be deployed. The weather will sometimes not be cooperative. Sometimes they'll be too long to deploy locally and here domestically. And so really having other options is really, really important. And so we're working here with the Appalachian Mountain Rescue Team to build a Mountain Rescue Association endorsed team in the Southeast. And I think that's an example of being facile and having lots of arrows in the quiver so that you can attack the problem multiple ways when your first or second or third option fails, your batteries run out, you drop your super cool portable ultrasound in the water, and you still have a patient who needs to be cared for.
Or you just have a Foley catheter.
Amen. I was going to get to that, but Ben, I think you had a follow-up on what he's talking about.
Yeah, right along with Seth is talking about, and that actually still goes back to even just the educational concepts that David was referring to, but we become very reliant, whether you're pre-hospital, you're first responder wilderness, you're in the hospital, with equipment and things. When you talk to juniors and colleagues all the time, when I talk to colleagues and juniors all the time, it's like, well, what would you do in this case? And give them a scenario, or we have a scenario right in front of us, like, oh, well, I'm going to use the GlideScope, or I'll use this. So I know my junior residents, and I say to them, oh, you like the Mac Blade? Well, boom, I take it away. I knew a junior resident was very used to using the GlideScope, and they would use it no matter what. So I put a piece of tape over it, and they didn't know how to problem solve and figure out why is that. They didn't even know that there's tape on there. They just were at a loss and couldn't think outside the box there. And it's same as if your piece of equipment that you're relying on doesn't work. You can say, and I've had paramedics, my urban medics, that have said to me, oh, well, you know, I'll put them on the monitor and the BP cuff that automatically will take, and I'll set it for every 2 minutes or 5 minutes or 10 minutes or whatever. And it doesn't matter how bundled up they are because I don't need to get right back to them. And then I say to them, okay, well, what if one of the leads comes off? What, you know, how do you put monitor leads on someone who's wet, which, you know, is something that we recently overcame. One of my medic firefighters for Miami-Dade on the fireboat found this awesome thing with basically these little suction cups, and they work great for electrodes when someone's wet, even a little bit damp. But you can't just rely on this equipment and talk about it. How do you let patients void if you're carrying them out or you're keeping them bundled up? How do you monitor their urinary output? How do you do different things when you drop that equipment or something breaks or, oops, I left it in the truck, which is, you know, 5 miles back? Having those different means and the abilities to not have to rely on such big equipment is very important. And similar to everything with backcountry, and I'm sure David can attest to, because what you use, you're carrying. What you need, you carry. Am I correct, David?
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the biggest challenges I think that we face in the search and rescue and wilderness medicine environment that we're in here, and I think that this probably is the same for other places, is that the nature of these settings is characterized by a lot of times poor communications infrastructure. A lot of times you have initial responders who are good Samaritans, fellow recreators, for example, who don't really have a lot of medical training. So you get really spotty dispatch information, even more so than sometimes occurs in the front country environment with just third-party callers. And I think a lot of people have experienced that. But, you know, you'll get a call for subject has fallen here. And is that a child? Is that a very large adult? How far did they fall? Is it just a broken leg, or is it a 200-footer off a cliff and it's going to be multi-system trauma? And so we're limited to what we're carrying on our back, just like Ben said. And sometimes what you're carrying is not correct for that call. So that's where you really have to know how to think outside the box and improvise and maybe turn to traditional wilderness medicine concepts of using the patient's own gear to improvise things like splints and carrying devices and stuff like that.
That's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I want to thank all of you for checking out the show this week, and of course, remind you to follow up on all of the information you get in this week's show over at the MedicCast blog. That's at mediccast.com/blog. Over there, you'll find a show notes link at the top of the page. Go ahead and take a moment and follow up on all of the information and links to news items and more you find there each week. You can also sign up for our email newsletter that'll bring you those links directly into your email inbox each week if you want. There's a form on the right-hand side of the page. Just go ahead and fill that out, and you can get the MedicCast newsletter for yourself. I also welcome your comments and suggestions by email. So if you want to get back in touch with me, shoot me an email to podmedic@mac.com. Send in your ideas for news links, ideas for future show topics or interviews, whatever comments you might have. I really do look forward to hearing from you, and I'll make sure I get back to you. I work hard to respond back to every email that comes in, so please keep those emails coming. If you want to catch up with me on social media and some of the pages and sites out there, you can find me at most places under the handle Podmedic. So you can catch me over at Twitter at twitter.com/podmedic or Facebook at facebook.com/podmedic. Friend or follow me over there. Also, don't forget to check out our MedicCast Facebook page. We now have over 5,000 followers, so head over to facebook.com/medicCast. Click the like button on the top of the page and join the community over there. That's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. Please make sure you spread the word and share the MedicCast with your colleagues and students and friends in the EMS world. I'll be back here each week with new episodes, new interviews, news items, tips, and more every Monday morning to start off your EMS week. Tell somebody else about the MedicCast today. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. It's time to close out the show. Don't forget to thank our sponsors, and remember, folks, Scene Safety, BSI.